Thank you. Yeah. Good afternoon, everyone. Well done. We've made it to our last session for the day. My name's Matt Purse, and I'll be your chair for today's session on ATO programs. So we're going to be focusing on a number of key things from top 100, top 1000, as well as reflections from a head of tax perspective, as well as matters that are attracting the ATO's attention. So I'm sure you'll be eager to hear all of those. Our speakers for today, Megan Croker and Dave Stevenson from the ATO's public groups area, together with Brian Purdy from South 32, who'll be offering insights from an industry perspective. As a courtesy to our speakers, please ensure that your mobile phones are switched off, and please reserve your questions for the end. Thank you. I'll now hand it over to Megan.
Thank you. Are we on? Yep. So today, Dave and I will talk a bit about the justified trust programs for public groups for our top 100 and top 1000 programs. We'll cover off our findings reports from those. This is really just a snapshot of what's in the findings report, but I encourage everybody to have a look at those findings reports, though something tells me everybody's already read it. So they're really important publications from our perspective. We use these to highlight where that group sits, and it enables taxpayers to understand where they sit in comparison to their peers, and as well as a way for us to communicate through to the market what we're seeing, what's attracting our attention, and ways that taxpayers can address those. Firstly, just touch on the programs. So the top 100 are taxpayers that make up our very largest public groups. Don't let the name fool you. I think at the moment there's about 84 in the top 100. They typically have turnover in excess of $5 billion, and or they are market leaders. Given the high concentration of corporate tax that's paid by these taxpayers, and the impact that their positions have on the health of the system, we engage with them on an ongoing basis to manage their compliance and assure their tax performance on an, annually. The objective here is to be in real time as much as possible, with the ultimate goal of influencing taxpayers prior to lodgement rather than correcting after lodgement has occurred. For the top 1,000, this is the next top 1,000 largest taxpayers outside the top 100. Given the size of this population, we take a slightly different approach in that we are assuring the 4 years retrospective when we undertake a compliance review. We look at 4 years for income tax and the last year, which is typically 12 business activity statements for GST. There's been a few iterations of the program where it was income tax and then a GST as a standalone assurance review. Then we combined them with income tax being assured and GST from a risk perspective. We now assure both income tax and GST in the same review. The product is more streamlined, so our aim is to undertake these reviews within a 4 to 6 month window. That often depends, though, on what's going on in the taxpayer's business, the amount of work that's involved, but that's sort of our rough benchmark. Where we identify things in our top 1,000 compliance assurance reviews that require further work, those will go through to our next action program. So that might be ATO intervention, where we undertake another specific review just on that particular issue that we've identified. Sometimes that goes straight through to audit. But we also have client next actions where we will say to the taxpayer, this is what you need to do to address our concerns. We might come back and look at that in the next review, or we might come back in a shorter time frame, but that's clearly identified for the taxpayer. I'm sure people are pretty comfortable with the four pillars, but I always like the house graph, so I've added that in there. So we look at tax governance frameworks, significant and or new transactions, tax risk flag to market, and get an understanding of the alignment between accounting through the audited financial statements and tax, and we look to understand any differences between the two. And that gives us a holistic picture, and taxpayers will then be given an overall assurance rating as a result of our review of all of those four pillars. One key thing around justified trust is what we are looking for is objective evidence to support the positions that are taken. So not necessarily narratives from the taxpayer, but we're actually looking for the underlying objective evidence. Dave, as one of the assistant commissioners who has a lot of clients in the ENR space for Top 100, will touch on the Top 100 findings report.
Thanks, Megan. Hopefully, I think that's working. So I'll talk about the Top 100 findings report and call out some key aspects of it. So we do, as a broad statement, see high levels of willing compliance in the Top 100 population. And particularly this year, we've got 82% of taxpayers in that population at either high or medium assurance. We've observed an increase in the number of high assurance taxpayers this year. So that percentage has gone from 52% in 2023 to 59% this year. So that means we've maintained or obtained assurance that these taxpayers have paid the right amount of tax for the year reviewed. 23% are medium assurance, and that's a reduction from 31% from the prior year. So what we've seen is a movement from our medium assurance population to our high assurance population. Our low assurance population has remained stable at 13%, and those taxpayers generally are subject to ongoing ATO compliance activity, either reviews or audits. Of note, for top 100 taxpayers who have received more than one tax assurance report, 58% have increased their assurance rating between their first review and their last review. We do continue to see significant material transactions in monitoring and maintenance and refresh review years. The stats that we have show that 83% of monitoring and maintenance reviews completed this year had significant or material transactions along with tax risk flag to market, and 96% of refresh reviews had looked at new transactions or tax risk flag to market. The other thing that we've observed in the population is that high assurance ratings tend to be sticky. So once a taxpayer does get to high assurance through the cycle of monitoring and maintenance reviews and refresh reviews, they generally tend to maintain that assurance. That said, we have seen a small number of taxpayers this year regress from high assurance to a lower rating, and that can be for a variety of reasons. But generally, it's because there are material areas of assurance that we have seen reductions in. Over time, in this population, generally, we are seeing a reduction in the entering into of high-risk transactions. So in terms of governance, as you can see on the slide, and as you would all be aware, tax governance is something that we're very focused on through our assurance programs. We see a lot of benefits to robust tax governance frameworks. So our aim here is to ensure the taxpayer has the appropriate working tax risk and governance frameworks in place based on their size and complexity. So it has to be tailored to their particular business. And we've published a lot of guidance in that space. So the stats are there on the screen in front of you. We do have a staged rating system with tax governance. So stage one is that there's a tax governance framework that exists. Stage two is that it's designed effectively. And stage three is where it's both designed effectively and is operating effectively. And that's through that's shown through independent testing. So as you can see, we've seen a notable increase. As you can see, there are a number of taxpayers now at stage three ratings in the top 100 population. That's increased significantly this year. Last year, 20% of taxpayers in the top 100 had a stage three rating. This year, that's gone to 35%. Practically, we expect that better tax governance will result in less inadvertent errors for the taxpayer, But at this stage, we haven't yet got the correlation between good tax governance and not entering into high-risk transactions or less of that occurring. That said, as a broad statement, we're seeing increased tax governance and less high-risk transactions in the top 100 population. So we'll move then to GST. So in terms of GST performance for the top 100 market, we've now completed an assurance review for one or more GST reporters for 88% of the top 100 economic groups. The outcomes are really positive. 93% have attained either overall high or medium assurance. This year we observed an increase in the number of taxpayers attaining high assurance. That's gone to 30% from 23% in 2023. And our overall low assurance population has remained stable at 2%. With regards to governance, over half of the top 100 GST reporters have obtained a stage 2 or stage 3 rating for tax governance, and 43% are at stage 1. One additional point I'll make with regards to GST in the top 100 market is we do see a significant error rate when we undertake these assurance reviews. 44% of the completed reviews had issues or concerns with regards to the correct reporting of GST obligations. Now, often those errors are not material in dollar terms. However, we have had some material errors, and in a small number of cases, we've also applied failure to take reasonable care penalties. In the GST space, we see those errors generally arise due to system issues or governance issues. The GST analytical tool, which isn't on the slide, I'll just quickly mention that. For those that don't know, that is a top-down methodology which is designed to understand the key differences between the financial statements that are audited and the GST reported on the BAS. This year we found that 86% of taxpayers who had the GAT applied attained a stage 2 or stage 3 rating for the GAT. So the top 100 program, we are constantly looking at enhancing that program, and earlier this year we announced a range of changes to the program to enhance it. So as Megan mentioned earlier, we have really refocused our efforts on real-time engagement. The Top 100 Justified Trust program was set up as a real-time program, but for various reasons over time, some taxpayers have fallen behind and the ATO has fallen behind with those taxpayers. It is important for us to be in real-time. As Megan said, we do focus on prevention over correction. So this year we've undertaken an effort to move taxpayers back to real time. We are aiming to have our top 100 population in real time by the end of next year is the rough time frame. And so practically that will result in two things. So the first is that significant and material transactions we'll be able to look at closer to the time of the event and work with the taxpayer to ensure that the outcomes are as they should be. There will obviously be mutual expectations in that we need engagement from the relevant taxpayers up front and early, and equally the ATO team needs to be available to work through it at that time. Equally, where we have fallen behind with some taxpayers, we'll be undertaking catch-up reviews to bring them back to real time. So, to achieve this, we'll be doing simultaneous tailored reviews across multiple years. So there will be a little bit of extra effort to get everyone back to real time. But certainly moving forward, we want to operate in that real time environment. Moving forward beyond that real time, we do want to try to keep people at real time. And so there will be stricter timeframes involved with our pre-lodgement compliance reviews. In addition, some other enhancements. We do continue to focus on scoping and tailoring our engagement. As I mentioned, we've observed that high assurance taxpayers, those ratings tend to be sticky, and the taxpayers do tend to maintain them. That being the case, we've brought in a third monitoring and maintenance year for high assurance taxpayers, and so that will mean that there'll be reduced engagement with us, and that will also assist with achieving real-time engagement. In addition, where we've got a domestic entity that is operating largely domestically, we will no longer be doing the effective tax-borne calculation for monitoring and maintenance and refresh reviews, although exceptional circumstances may warrant us doing it. With regards to GST, in refresh reviews, we'll take a tailored approach to GST data testing and transaction testing. Our testing will be informed across the four pillars, but we will look to tailor that. In addition, we've made some changes to the way that we get sufficient coverage. So previously, we would look to get coverage over 75% of the GST throughput through assurance reviews. Now, provided that we can get GST throughput above 50% for two assurance reviews, we'll look to make up the additional percentage through specific reviews rather than full-blown assurance reviews. And with that, I will pass back to Megan to talk about the top 1,000 findings report.
Thanks, Dave. So moving now to the results for the top 1,000 program. So across the SARs and the CARs, so since 2016, we've now reviewed 1,183 taxpayers, and 343 of those we've reviewed for a second time. So as at their last review, we had 24% at high assurance, the majority in medium assurance, and 14% achieved at low assurance. As you can appreciate, given the size of the population, any of those shifts quite, you know, incremental year on year. So if we look at those that we reviewed in 2024, we had 27% at high assurance and 9% at low assurance. So we're gradually seeing that shift from low assurance into medium and medium up to high. We'll also see improvements for taxpayers that we review for the second time. So as you can see from the graph there, for those that have read the findings report in detail, no, that's everyone. We've got a number of ways in the report that we look at our second reviews. So this one here just looks at the outcomes for everybody's first time review and then the second time review. And you can see there that significant shift from the low assurance and that gradual increase in the high assurance. That shift in the low really came from the reviews that we looked at last year. So for the reviews that we looked at in 2024, 22% of those had low assurance in their first review, and I think that shifted to 5% on their second review, so really shifted a lot from that low assurance. I think when we look at in the findings report, we do split it by industry, so those in the mining, energy and water sector echo those improvements, where we have seen that shift where 14% were at low on their first review and 8% in their second review, as well as that gradual increase in those that were getting at high assurance. Income tax governance is something that's been a real focus in the top 1,000. What we can see here is that for all taxpayers as at their last review, we had 40% at stage two or three. You can see from the graph on the right there, the gradual shift out of those for stage one from last year's results to this year's results and the increase for stage two and stage three. And that's been a feature that we've seen since we released our supplementary governance guide for the top 1,000 in 2022. So what we did there was recognising that there was such a significant difference in the types of businesses that made up the top 1,000 population was we gave examples of what governance looked like for a business type that was predominantly domestic, for those that were inbound, those that were outbound, and that's really assisted the market to understand what our expectations are and what we look for, what governance looks like in those different types of businesses. So for the reviews that we did last year, 59% of taxpayers reviewed were at stage two or stage three governance. So there's a real shift for income tax, which we've seen over the last few years. And we see that as well in the mining, energy and water sector, where we've got that increase around 42% on their second review had a stage two or stage three rating. what we're starting to, you know, 2 years ago the discussion was around what do I need to show for stage two to show that my my governance controls are designed effectively. Now we get asked a lot of questions around what do I need to show to the ATO to get to stage three. So we really are hearing in the market that the discussion has shifted to how do I get to a stage three. So what we're after there is we want to understand what testing took place. So we want to understand what the methodologies were, the sample size, what were the source documents that were relied upon. A lot of that set out in the testing plan. We want to see the final results of the testing. We want to understand for any areas of concern that were identified by the independent tester was what steps have been taken to address those. And we want to see the board acknowledgement of the testing and the actions that have done to address those concerns. We also set out in our findings report those significant tax areas that we review, and those have remained pretty consistent, and they're pretty consistent from the top 1,000 and the top 100. So transfer pricing is one of the areas that we see the highest number of low assurance and the lowest number of high assurance. What we really see there, particularly for those that are low assurance, is not just concerns with the pricing, but we find taxpayers who don't have any contemporaneous documentation. So there's nothing that outlines to us what it is that the transaction fundamentally is, where the risk's sitting between the parties. We don't have visibility over how the pricing was set. We don't know what the benchmarking was and how those calculations came to be. So that is the information we will always ask for, and in the absence of that, a low assurance is pretty much where we will sit. We do rely a lot on PCGs, particularly in transfer pricing, so we will look for the RTP disclosures around how did taxpayers rate against our PCGs and what's the evidence, or look for the evidence of around how they determined what their rating was. Low assurance is also prevalent in hybrids, particularly imported hybrids, and again we look at the PCG. So what we look for there is the process that the taxpayers have undertaken to identify any potential imported hybrid mismatches, and we look for the evidence to show that that process was actually followed. I note that while UCA continues to be an area where the majority of taxpayers are getting high assurance, there are still taxpayers that are rated as low for UCA. Particularly that's around a lack of documentation to support self-assessment of effective lives. So people have not adopted the Commissioner's effective lives, but we can't see any evidence to support what the taxpayers determined as the effective life. A bit around GST. So we're not as far through the population for GST as we are for income tax, which is partly due to commencement of GST assurance in 2019, so a few years after, as well as having the separate, like the two-step approach to get to a GST assurance. And a lot were reviewed for our cars as a risk approach, but we're not necessarily assured. So we've looked at 735, but around 500 of those for an actual assurance review. As you can see, 37% are at high assurance at their most recent review. Last year, it was around 44%. We only have 4% of the population at low assurance for GST, and that remains fairly stable. Typically, that's where we see an absence of evidence for governance frameworks combined with a low assurance for the gap. As you know, there's not a lot where we have difference of technical opinion for GST. It's more that there's sort of nothing there for governance or not enough there for us to meet our expectations. The GAT became a compulsory element of the combined assurance review. I'm lost whether it was last year or the year before. I think it was the end of the 2022. As you can see, there's 74% have reached a stage three or a high assurance for the GAT. So I know there was a lot of nervousness when it first came in, but we are seeing taxpayers reaching that high assurance. A lot of taxpayers are quite comfortable with the GAT to a large degree on the revenue side. For the acquisition side, that's where we see taxpayers really need to involve the finance department. They're the ones that will better understand timing differences, whether they're permanent or temporary, to assist with that GATT side for acquisitions. Governance in GST, as you can see, the majority of the population are at a stage one for governance. It has only been in the last year that we've seen that positive shift towards a stage two or three. So last year was the first year that we really saw 50% of the population were at stage two or three for GST. So I think it's, shows, the income tax shifted and now it's GST starting to come along for that. As we see more taxpayers talk about stage three and what it takes to get to stage three, one of the things to be really careful of is there's no point undertaking testing to confirm operational effectiveness of the controls if the controls are not designed effectively. So we don't require taxpayers to wait until we do a review and say, yes, you're at stage two. But when you, if a taxpayer comes to us and says, I think I'm at stage three and I've done my operational testing for GST, and the last time we reviewed them, they were at stage one, we will do a check to confirm, yes, you're at stage two and the controls are designed effectively. So that's an important thing, particularly with GST where, a lot of taxpayers got to stage two for income tax, now looking for stage three, but their GST was at stage one. And we don't want taxpayers to undertake that testing and get to stage two, but not at stage three, but not have ticked off that they're at stage two. Like in Top 100, we also see a lot of GST errors. And these are, again, they're not material, but one of the concerning things for us is that 40% of cars that we initiate result in a voluntary disclosure for GST. Now, voluntary disclosures are not by themselves a bad thing, but what concerns us is that we don't see them until we initiate a review. So taxpayers are not undertaking checks on a regular basis as part of their governance process to confirm that their GST reporting was correct. It is only once we intervene that that happens, which in a way suggests that we need to keep intervening, which is not necessarily where we want to be. So we would hope to see that more taxpayers undertaking those reviews for GST on a more regular basis and making voluntary disclosures on a more regular basis and not just once we initiate a review. So earlier this year, we made some announcements about the Top 1000 program. As I mentioned earlier, we've reviewed 343 taxpayers for a second time. Last year it was around 250. And what we saw was that stickiness for assurance was prevalent in the top 1,000 market as it was in the top 100. So it became a question to us around, well, do we need to keep looking at taxpayers as intensely as we need to, as we were before, where they have shown us that they've got good governance and that they're at medium or high assurance. At the same time, what we saw was the number of taxpayers in the top 1,000 had significantly increased. So we set the threshold at 250 million turnover in 2016, because that's pretty much where the population, those largest thousands sat. But obviously over time, after 8 years, that number was significantly more, and we weren't able to get taxpayers on a regular cycle because there were more taxpayers for us to look at than we wanted to, and we were doing more first-time reviews than we had anticipated we would be at that point. The intention was always to look at 1,000, so now we are going to bring it back to the 1,000 and just look at those 1,000 taxpayers. We're not raising the threshold, but I will say that 1,000 at this point is sitting around a 350 turnover threshold, but we will still be looking at that 1,000, not just changing the threshold. The other thing, as you can appreciate, is at the top of the top 1,000 to those at the lower end of the top 1,000 is a real difference. And we've got a third of the population that sits at over $1 billion in turnover. And given the significant size of those taxpayers, we want to maintain the level of intensity that we have for them. So we will continue to assure all 4 years for those taxpayers. But where we have those taxpayers with stage two or three for governance and a medium or high assurance rating, we will tailor our engagement, and we will look to focus on the last year of objective evidence as much as we can to seek that assurance over the 4 years. So instead of asking for work papers for all 4 years for all issues, it will be more tailored around how much can we just rely on the last year of objective evidence. For those the other two-thirds of the population where the TBI is below $1 billion, we will assure the last year of economic activity as well as any significant issues that arise in the other 3 years, any disclosures, any new transactions, any new changes of law that might come in that period. So the aim there is to get assurance using the last year as well as identify any other areas that that stand out as significant and requiring assurance. In all of these, we are taking a much more tailored approach, and we are looking really, now that we've sort of isolated those top 1,000, doing more to top up the assurance that we had already attained through that process. For GST, because we're not as far through the population, what we have got is that those taxpayers who have not yet been assured, we will continue to assure in the same way that we currently do, which is to look at those last 12 BAS. I think about two months ago, we announced that we would be introducing the supplementary annual GST return for taxpayers in the top 100 and top 1,000 market that have been assured. And what we'll look for in that return is to understand the taxpayer's position on certain GST items. So those are things like, where is the governance at? What recommendations from our reviews have been actioned? Any issues that have been identified and corrections that were made, and where the GAT's at? And we will use that information from that return to determine how our GST assurance looks going forward, what that engagement looks like going forward. So, for example, for a taxpayer where they have reached stage 2 or 3 governance, they are at medium or at high, and we have comfort over the actions that they have taken, and that return will give us more information around what's happening in the business. It may be that we do not undertake further GST assurance reviews. We may just look at certain items that come out of that, or depending on where the taxpayer is, say, for example, a stage 1 governance rating, or one that might have significant business changes in that period, then we may still undertake an assurance review. For the supplementary annual GST return, so this will be a requirement for all taxpayers who have been assured up to the 30th of June 2024. And these are the dates that we expect those returns will go out. So that's typically around 7 months after the end of your financial year. For taxpayers that have a GST assurance and we anticipate we'll have a car before the 21st of August, we will be engaging with those taxpayers ahead of that car so that we can bring in the benefits of this where appropriate. So some taxpayers will get a phone call that says, we think, we anticipate you will have a car next year. Let's engage on the supplementary annual GST return ahead of that. And then we will determine what that car looks like. If you're part of that group, either you have had a phone call this week or last week by one of my teams, or it will be coming very soon. There is a lot more information. This is a very quick snapshot of the supplementary annual GST return. There's a lot of information on the website as well. About that, and as well as a copy of the return, so you can see what types of questions there are going to be in the return. Dave?
It's me. Okay, so I thought I'd just provide a couple of quick slides regarding, and this is more in regards to the energy and resources sector itself. And so as you can see there, so this data that's on the screen comes from our latest release, Corporate Tax Transparency Report. So that's the 10th one of those we've released. This year was the first time that population has included privately owned corporate groups with turnover above 100 million. So that population is now any corporate entity turning over $100 million, along with PRRT tax payable entities. So this year that's spoken about is a 2022-23 year, and it was a record $97.9 billion of tax payable from corporates within the population, and that was up 16.7% on the prior year. So when you add in the additional tax revenue raised by the Tax Avoidance Task Force, that's nearly $100 billion coming from large corporates in the 2022-23 year, obviously very significant to the Australian revenue base. I wanted to highlight the contribution the mining, energy and water segment has made to that population, to those amounts. As highlighted on this slide, the MEW, the mining, energy and water population, is only 8.6% of entities in the population, but has paid more tax than the other segments combined for that year. And that was consistent with the prior year as well. So this particular segment of the market is responsible for over half of corporate income tax in Australia. So that tax performance was supported by elevated commodity prices over that particular year, particularly regarding thermal coal, oil, gas and lithium. Of note, the oil and gas sector increased tax payable from $1.5 billion in 2021-2022 to $11.6 billion in 2022-23. So naturally, given the significance of this sector to Australia's corporate tax base, it does attract a lot of attention from the ATO. Certainly some of our interventions have assisted in ensuring the right amount of taxes payable for the year in question. So I guess the takeaway is that the energy and resources sector is critically important to the corporate tax base in Australia. Might go to the next slide. I won't spend too long on this slide. This is a graphic illustration of the tax payable by the corporate tax transparency population the prior year versus now, and the contribution of the various industry segments to that increase. And so you can see there that the mining, energy and water segment was largely responsible for the increase in tax paid by large corporates for that year. That said, given the movement of commodity prices post the 2022-23 year, we do expect there to be a fairly significant, I'm not sure if significant is the right word, but a reasonable decline in tax payable by the segment. And so there will be a challenge for both industry and the ATO on the release of data next year to explain to the Australian public the nature of why that has happened, to ensure that there's the correct information out in the public domain. So we might roll to the next one. So just quickly, I thought I'd touch on some items that attract our attention in the energy and resources segment. As you can see on the list there, the top three are related to what we call global profit shifting risks. Now, global profit shifting risks for the ATO, they make up around 65% of our audit program in the large market. It's an area that obviously Australia has a reasonably high corporate tax rate, and so as a jurisdiction, we are susceptible to global profit shifting. So they're prevalent in the E&R industry, albeit most we consider to be, it's by exception rather than the rule. As I mentioned earlier, we do find very high levels of compliance across this segment. The next two, uniform capital allowances and R&D, are a bit more specific to the sector. Obviously, in this sector, it's a capital-intensive business, so UCA is reasonably prominent. A lot of assets that are on the fixed asset registers, and the sector is also innovative. So we do see some risks arising in the R&D space. I have included governance there, and that's largely based on the discussion that Megan and I mentioned before. So there's some items that do continue to attract our attention. However, I will re-emphasise that by and large, the industry is very compliant with its tax obligations. And so I might pass over to Brian.
Thank you. Thanks. So I've been coming to a number of these, and every session has an ATO session around programs. So I just thought I'd give some reflections about how do you deal with specific changes in ATO programs over time, given that you need to be constant in your approach to tax. So I was thinking, if I was at this conference 10 years ago at the break, I'd probably be talking footy with people, and people would be telling me the Dockers are in their premiership window, and they'd probably tell me that now. Someone would tell me St Kilda's rebuilding 10 years ago, and they probably, that'd be true. But I'd be talking about how the Eagles looked really good for the future, and I can't say I do that now. So, and similarly, the ATO session would have talked about the desire for real time and taxpayers' desire for certainty. So that's still constant through this process. You would have heard things about advanced compliance agreements, which we don't hear about anymore. We would have heard about pre-compliance reviews, which you don't hear anymore. It would have been MEU, not MEW. So utilities are out, water are in. You would have thought SARS was either influenza or the South African revenue. You would have thought cars was what you drove or a port or a cartoon. But you wouldn't have heard about stage 1, 2, 3. You wouldn't have heard about governance frameworks. And you wouldn't have heard about justified trust. But the top five of those 6 points would have been the main emphases of the program 10 years ago. So if you move on to the next slide. So what do you do about this as a head of tax? Because you've got to be constant in your company. So I think regardless of the programs, you've got to identify that really you've got to have a principled and consistent approach to all matters through time. And if you have principles and a consistent approach, then you'll be predictable and consistent. And I think regardless of ATO programs and the emphasis on what they call them, if you have a principled and a consistent approach to your tax affairs, it stands you in good stead, makes you predictable and builds alignment inside the company, so it supports the tax function, and also I think builds credibility externally, including the ATO. I think what you've heard now, and I reflect on, is that everything can and likely will be reviewed, and it's important in a company to remember, whether you're top 100 or top 1,000, that monitors an ATO review principle only, and it's not a guarantee. The best thing you could do then, and you can do now, is identify what's likely to be contentious. If you identify it, that's always a good thing. We're always more likely to have an issue with something that we get blindsided on or don't pick up than we will with something that we pick up on an early basis, particularly if we're dealing with our tax in a principled approach. And it won't matter what the ATO program specifically is. If you've got that approach, you'll end up in a good place. At all times, record keeping's an investment, but remember, what's sufficient and appropriate will likely change over time. A lot of the problems that people have come into have been when maybe record keeping expectations changed. There was a big change around record keeping expectations when self-assessment came in. What justified trust effectively represented was a back to the future around record keeping, and I think that part of that was just a misalignment around expectations of what record keeping should be. And so I think always be aware what should be your record keeping obligations, and they really shouldn't move too much regardless of changes in ATO programs. And similarly, I think keeping regular communication routines with the ATO is always important regardless of the program. I just think that understanding is always really important. More specifically with the ATO, I would say just understand what their expectations are at any point. You definitely should understand what they're trying to do, but always be mindful that programs and emphasis do change over time. And also that if you have global operations, you can't take ATO practices and apply them all around the world. You just have to apply your principles. And I think in my experience, if you explain that in that context, that's understood. A lot of contentions in ATO programs, in my experience, come because it isn't a one-size-fits-all program. So just because someone had a certain outcome or certain depth of review under a program doesn't mean another one's going to be, because they're principles that get applied in different circumstances. Importantly, with programs, context can be lost over time without good contemporary records. I think we all need to remember that whenever anyone's reviewing 2020 or 2021, now that 2020 and 2021 were different. There was COVID, people were working from home, they weren't working in teams, things were different in the ATO, things were different in corporates, and it's really easy for people to forget that context. And if that's the case, then people aren't going to remember other issues that were going on in the business, no one's going to remember ERP or any other business changes unless you write them down and keep your records. So regardless of the program, that's always good. Certainty is a worthy goal, a bit like a Fremantle Premiership, but it can be elusive in practice. And ACAs are a really great example of that. In 10 years' time, there'll be discussions here about real time. There'll probably still be discussions about the same PRRT issues as well. But you know, certain things, it'll just be how they apply in certain time. And you need to move your resourcing and be responsive to change circumstances in companies. And I think a lot of companies have been caught out by not talking with inside their company about changed ATO expectations. And I think the justified trust programs are really good examples of that. So I knew we'd be tight for time. So apart from giving a few reflections, I wanted to make sure that we did get some questions for the ATO. Now, Matt, I had some, but you've got some, so it's up to you how you want to...
How about we go with yours first, Brian?
Sure.
I do have quite a few, actually,
oh, cool.
on the iPad as well.
Cool, okay. Okay. So I looked at, I reflect on the earlier slides, and I just wanted to ask, of the 2004 total assurance outcomes, what percentage of top 100 and top 1,000 does this represent? So how many people are up to date at 2024 as we stand here now, roughly?
So in terms of the findings report itself, that's the latest review of taxpayers under that tax assurance program. So that picks up all taxpayers. In terms of how many taxpayers are currently at real time, I think it's fair to say that it's not a large number. I think most taxpayers are perhaps generally a year behind, sometimes mm-hmm. two. So there's a bit of work to do on the catch up. Okay. This is in the top 100 market.
Okay. And are E&R segment members broadly reflective of that general status?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so E&R is reflective of the broader yeah. the broader group.
And how should people here therefore expect the catch-up plans to be agreed?
Sure, so there's work that is undertaken internal to the ATO first. So we have our top 100 network that works with the engagement and assurance teams to agree a scope for what looks like, what a catch-up review needs to look like to meet the criteria. And then there'll be engagement between the E&A team and the taxpayer to agree that forward work program. As I said before, there's going to be a little bit of pain on both sides to get there, but it will be very much based on the particular circumstances of the taxpayer. And as you mentioned before, no taxpayer is the same in this market.
Okay, so on the next one, if we go back to the issues for E&R, offshore hubs, related party sales, related party financing, UCA and R&D, they've been around a long time. I mean, UCA has been around since the early 2000s. Do you see an opportunity for more certainty in these areas? Because it seems like we've been talking about project pools for a long time. We've been talking about exploration for a long time. And I'm just wondering, is there anything in ATO programs to help get more certainty there?
Yeah, look, it's a complex question. I mean, more certainty is obviously a desire for both the ATO and industry. One of the difficulties we find, obviously, is that taxpayers are in quite different circumstances, and some of the matters that come before us are very facts and circumstances dependent. That said, we are always interested in areas, particularly arising from industry, of parts of the law that would benefit from further certainty from the ATO, whether that's via public advice and guidance or another avenue. With things like UCA, which you just mentioned, we actually tend to find that the issues are more systems-based around, as I said before, it's a capital-intensive industry. There are a lot of assets, and sometimes we find errors in the fixed asset registers that causes, I guess, the problem. But I think, in short, where there are areas that we can provide greater guidance on, we are very, very keen to hear about those.
Okay, so that's an invitation to engage. The last one for me, for really just an update for everyone on the ENR working group. I think some people in this room are in the group, but I think everyone would be interested to understand what the group's done. I think there was a recent meeting and just what the program is.
Sure, that's me again. So we did have a meeting of the ENR working group yesterday. That's an important working group for the ATO. It involves key ATO stakeholders with representatives of industry associations and the large advisory firms and other key stakeholders. It's something that we take very seriously. In terms of what's coming up for that working group, there's a subcommittee looking at decommissioning and potentially bringing out some further advice in the decommissioning space. That's obviously becoming more and more relevant as the life cycle matures. And equally, many in the room would be aware of the Future Made in Australia package of measures. So whilst not before Parliament at the moment, to the extent that they do go before Parliament and become law, there's going to be a real lift needed to get everyone in the position to be able to access those incentives and for guidance to be out there so that everyone's aware of what the playing field is at the time. So I expect over the next 12 months that will be a focus of the ENR working group as well.
Great, thank you. Look, I do have a number of questions that have come through online, but are there any questions in the room before I start to ask? Can we get a microphone over there, please?
Thank you. Thanks to the ATO, and Megan, you're probably wondering what you've done wrong to have me asking you questions twice in a week, but I'm here, so I'm going to. It's actually interesting timing. The CTA just sent off a letter to the Commissioner this afternoon about a couple of issues that we talked to him about at the convention, which was in October. And one of the areas that we have sort of questioned or asked the Commissioner to look at more carefully is, and the title of it is, just so I get it right, Transparency, the ATO's role in contributing to public perceptions of the large market. Now, obviously the taxpayers in this room are the largest contributors to the corporate revenue stream, and as such they are the most susceptible to data or information provided by the ATO that isn't fulsome or is misleading. So without suggesting that these are, I think a statistic like 65% of audit cases are related to global profit shifting needs to be, you need some more granular sort of information around that. I mean, from what I understand from your settlements report, global profit shifting includes Part 4A, it includes transfer pricing, it includes, so essentially anyone in this room that operates in more than one jurisdiction, any dispute they have with the ATO is likely to be global profit shifting according to that definition. In relation to GST, I think those numbers around voluntary disclosures, 40% for top 1,000, 44 for top 100, again, granularity there is really important. I mean, some of the voluntary disclosures I've heard of are tiny in the context of enormous taxpayers who have invested significant resources in ensuring their governance processes are up to speed. Now, no governance process is necessarily going to capture every single possible manual error that occurs. So it's really important when you're talking about these numbers, you say 44% there's a voluntary disclosure. When that sort of information is in the public domain and senators get a hold of it, you know, that can look completely different in terms of what it actually looks like. So I just encourage the ATO today, and in our letter we have encouraged them to do that.
Yeah, we got a number of questions we want to get through, so if we can answer that one.
I think, like, I understand, you know, some of those broader high-level statistics and granularity. I think we're always mindful of where that right point for granularity is around, you know, there's only so much that we can disclose and where's the right point to make sure that we're not going too deep. I think, as I mentioned earlier around the GST, like, we know that they're immaterial, but for us it signals the issues with governance And that's sort of, I guess, the point that we try and draw out of the voluntary disclosure point more than what those issues are and the size of them is the governance side of things. Now, we are seeing those improvements in GST this year. This year has been the real shift for GST governance, and so hopefully we'll see that flow-on effect for a reduction in that. But I think it is an important point in that, we're really focused on GST governance because GST governance will give us comfort that we can kind of take a step back from the intensive GST assurance reviews, combined with, for example, the supplementary annual GST return. But we also need to be, I guess, comfortable that if we do that, taxpayers will still be looking. And at the moment, what we see is that taxpayers don't do that until we come and start a review. So I think our point there is more around the governance side of those reviews rather than the monetary value or the materiality of those disclosures.
Thanks. Okay, an online question. What efforts are being made by the ATO to ensure a consistent approach by case officers across the review programs, particularly with tax governance?
Sure. So for both programs, Top 100 and Top 1000, we have got people that sit across all of those. So for Top 1000, I've got people for income tax and GST, and they sit on all of the panels to have that consistency across all of the cases. We also use the guidance, so for that supplementary guidance, governance guidance for Top 1000 that I talked about, our staff use that as much as clients. So that's where we look for that consistency in there. I think one of the things, though, particularly for Top 1000, I talk about Top 1000 because that's my program more than the Top 100. But what the other thing about governance that we're really focused on is it being fit for purpose, which is really a bit of a hard concept to kind of explain. But we don't want the governance that applies for one taxpayer to be the policy that sits on the shelf for another taxpayer if that's not what is right for that business, because then it won't be a lived practice. It will just be sort of, I guess, the document that sits there. So consistency has to be balanced with making sure that what we're looking for is actually fit for purpose for the particular business that we're looking at.
Thank you. Okay, a question for Brian. How do you deal with the cost, so time and financial, of dealing with the ATO?
Not a footy question. Okay. You can ask me those later. I think dealing with the ATO is just part of being a top 100. So certainly since the start of South 32, we've had a regular program of quarterly meetings with the ATO. We make meetings to... we've done the pre-lodgement meeting, we've done the post-lodgement meeting, and we've tried to have a timetable that we keep to, even if ATO programs change or emphases change. I think we've still tried to keep those meetings going. One of the benefits of that is it's actually built into our FTEs and our workload, is that we expect that basically doing the same work papers to the same level every year, having the same number of meetings, basically produces a cost that's just part of running the tax program. I think that has the benefit of not saying, well, I need more expenses this year, I can take cuts next year. And the Australian tax team in South 32 has been reasonably consistent in terms of size because of that. And I think it's just realistic discussions with your senior leadership, and certainly meetings between the senior leadership and the tax team, and that the ATO at the right time also just helps that common understanding. So I think just treat it as a cost of doing business and just build it into your BAU planning.
Thanks. I'm conscious of time, so I'll ask the question as the most votes. Is there any evidence that external stakeholders, such as investors and civil society organisations, value assurance ratings for listed companies?
My perspective. Civil society for South 32 doesn't really care about Australia. They kind of differentiate between developing countries and Western or developed countries. They figure for Australia, the ATO is big enough to beat up on us or keep us honest. They're more focused on South America and Africa and investors and all that, I think, just want predictability of numbers and threats to no threats to financial positions. And I think if tax becomes a material concern, then that's the case. But I think that's been the case all along.
Thank you, Brian. Can we all give a round of applause for Megan, Brian and Dave today? Thank you very much. Look, just a reminder to complete the evaluation on the attendee hub. That includes day one of the conference. So I'd like to now invite everyone for the networking event. And a reminder that we kick off at 8:30 tomorrow for day two. Thank you very much.